So, Eugene asked me to come tonight and speak with the Sangha about chanting practice and devotional practice. And the way that we began our sitting tonight was a traditional chant done in the Theravadan countries, Burma, Thailand, Sri Lanka, in the language of Pali, which is the language that the earliest Buddhist scriptures are written down in. And it's the language that the suttas that we practice and study are written in. And you can feel, even just in the beginning of our practice, before sitting, that it has a number of different qualities that it brings up in us, the chanting. And I would just like to speak to a few of those and explore that a little bit, and we'll also do some chanting together. When our teachers came back to the West from Asia in the early 70s, having studied in Burma and Thailand and India, they had practiced in these very traditional systems there, where chanting every day was a large part, particularly of monastic practice. And when they brought the practices here to America and Europe, one of the things that they did, they really made a conscious choice to leave behind a lot of the ritual and cultural elements of the practice, and to really bring quite primarily the meditation practices, the Vipassana practices, the Shamatha practices that we do here. And they felt that, in a way, sitting in meditation was strange enough without adding chanting in a foreign language, offering our praise to deities or Buddhas or archetypes that we may not be familiar with. And so they brought over really what they felt would work, what was the most skillful. So this was upaya, skillful means, this quality the Buddha teaches of, that bodhisattvas, or teachers, offer what would be most skillful for the particular people that they're working with. So Jack and Joseph and Sharon, our immediate lineage here, left behind most of the chanting. And if you do retreat at Spirit Rock or IMS, sometimes you'll do a little bit of chanting in the morning or evening. This chant that we did, Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhasa, or chanting the refuges at the beginning of retreat, sometimes chanting the precepts, the guidelines for moral action. From teacher to teacher it varies. But in the Asian traditions, there's a lot more, a vast amount of chanting, and it's considered a really important part of practice. So now that the Western Sangha is really maturing in the meditation practice, has really taken on the instructions that were brought, and are really beginning to explore practice in quite broad ways, taking it on in many aspects of our lives, then the chanting practices have emerged as another aspect of practice that we can explore, that we can bring into our personal practice, and particularly that we can share with each other. Because the chanting, one of the most obvious but potent aspects of the chanting practice is that it's a sangha practice. It's something that we do together. We manifest these chants, these words, these mantras with our voice, and we hear each other, and we become one voice together as we're chanting. So it can be quite a lovely practice to do in a group of people, in your sangha, as a way of feeling each other, knowing, oh, here we all are together practicing. And the chants are of several different types of chants, or a different way to say it is there are different aspects to the chanting practice. And I'd like to go through and speak to a few of them, and then we'll do some chanting together as well. In the monastic tradition, the chants are used in a few ways, sometimes as chants that are like what we could call prayer, what we in the West would call prayer. So they're chants of offering our respect or our devotion toward something. So for instance, in Buddhist practice, the object that receives the most veneration is the triple jewel, or the three gems of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. These three sort of seed locations where the practice springs out of and is manifested. And so so many of the chants in the tradition are chants around refuge. They're chants honoring the Buddha, honoring the Dharma, honoring the Sangha. So the chant we did in the beginning is a chant honoring Buddha. So the chant is Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhasa. And the words are just different words that were given as kind of ritual names to the Buddha while he was alive, and then since then as offering to praise. So Namo means I bow to. It's the same as in the yoga tradition, you'll hear namaste. Or if you travel in Tibet, Nepal, India, you'll hear as a general salutation on the street, you'll meet someone and they'll say namaste or namaskar. And that nama is I bow to you. And so namo, also I bow. Namo tassa bhagavato means blessed one. And it's one of the names most commonly used for the Buddha when he was alive. And it's still used for sages in India. Some sages will be called Bhagavan. Bhagavan means blessed one. And even built into the word is a mystery, or is a mystical practice, that the root of the word Bhagavan, Bhaga, in Sanskrit traces back down to the root of the word for womb, for the womb of a woman. And so there's a way that even using this word to describe the Buddha, this man who awoke and taught awakening, is a way of offering this very mysterious homage of I bow before the one who is the womb of wisdom, who has actually transcended male, female, and arises out of the infinite feminine, actually. And so we can hear it in so many different levels, right? On the surface level of just blessed one. And that's what they called him. At the beginning of the suttas, many of them would start with a monk saying, you know, blessed one, and then a question. What about this? What about that? And he would respond. And then on deeper and deeper levels, we're acknowledging these other aspects of blessedness, or of Buddha, of awakeness. So, chanting the refuges, chanting a chant of honor to the Buddha, or honor to the Dharma, honor to the Sangha, is a way of taking our inner intention that we're here practicing together. We've devoted some time of our lives, of some hours, or some years, or some decades, to the cultivation of the heart through these practices that are offered from the Buddha. So, as we deepen in those practices, we also deepen in our relationship to the source of the practices. And one of the ways to express that is by singing to that. Even just there, then I have to stop and say, singing to isn't quite right. So here's something that's really particular about much of the chanting practice is that we chant to something. This is a chant to the Buddha. In the translations, you know, he is the blessed one, the awakened one, the perfected one, the teacher of gods and humans, the knower of worlds. Different ways we're setting up this seemingly external figure of Buddha. Or in different chants of different bodhisattvas, male and female, different aspects of awakened nature. And it's a little paradox, because as we deepen in meditative practice, and as we hear the subtler teachings of non-self and of union, of oneness, it becomes clear that there's not actually something outside of ourselves, that there's not actually a Buddha out there. And the Zen practitioners really love this truth, and they teach it a lot in really fun, pointed ways. You know, this old saying, if you, from China, if you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him. Right? What would that mean, kill him? You know, it means, one level of its meaning is that if you think you've met the Buddha on the road and it's outside of yourself, you got it wrong. It's not the Buddha. Kill that thought. And there's a story that that Jack tells about Ajahn Chah, where a young monk saw Ajahn Chah smoking and, you know, gossiping and sitting with his feet up on the porch and just sort of being what seemed like a sloppy monk. And, you know, this is one of the most revered monastic teachers of the century in Thailand. And this young Westerner was like, he's not a very good example. And you know, kind of really bucked up his courage to go to Ajahn Chah and say something about this. And you know, kind of planned out everything he was going to say and went to the teacher and bowed and did all the formalities and said, you know, venerable teacher, I'm a little confused. You know, you tell us to be completely pure in our monk's code and our actions and all this, and yet I see you doing this and this and this and this. What about that? And Ajahn Chah looks at him and says, it's really good that you don't see me as perfect. Because if you did, you might get the idea that the Buddha is outside yourself. And that would be wrong. And the young monk, chastened, you know, sort of slinks away, like, oh dear, okay, I get it. So the Buddha, the teachings, as they deepen in us, we hear, we can feel the Buddha, this quality of awakeness, of full resting in the nature of what is, isn't separate from this one sitting here. Isn't out there somewhere. But feeling this one here as fullness, as the infinite, as true nature itself, is quite difficult for most people. To just sit down and rest in my being Buddha. Mostly I can just tell there's ego, not Buddha. So it's not so easy. So then traditions come up with these things outside. We come up with these beautiful images of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, of Tara Bodhisattva, you know, manifesting, sitting on a lotus flower, gleaming white with, you know, flowers in her hands and, you know, radiating peace and bliss in all directions and infinite compassion. So that when I need compassion, when things are rough for me, and I can't summon it up in myself to love myself enough to be easy on myself in a moment of difficulty, I can say the mantra of Tara, Om Tare Tuttare Ture Swaha, and I can bring up this image of this amazing goddess. And that doing that works. So this falls under the category of upaya, of skillful means. And it really becomes a skillful use of duality. So we understand these teachings of non-duality. But when it's useful, I pray. And part of chanting practice, part of devotional practice, is to not let that be a dissonance, to not become confused about inner and outer. And in some of the practices that really emphasize this praying to these amazing images of the divine, like the Tibetan tradition, there are these, you know, fabulous mandalas and images of these divine archetypes of Manjushri and Vajrasattva and Padmasambhava and Tara. And you visualize them as if it's something outside yourself, but then you always bring it in. And you take the visualization into your heart, you expand it to fill your body, you actually become that one. So that it's not about praying to something outside, but becoming that thing. In the same way you'll hear in the Christian tradition that deeper than the practice of praying to Christ, Jesus, is the practice of the imitation of Christ, the practice of becoming Christ-like. And it's said the same way in the Buddhist tradition, jokingly sometimes for us in the West, teachers will say, please don't become Buddhist, become Buddha. So the skillful use of duality is pointed to in a few different traditions. And it's pointed to in the yoga tradition as well. I just want to read a little verse from the Bhagavad Gita, this song of the divine from the Hindu tradition. Because this question really comes up in here, in the dialogue between the questioner, the student, Arjuna, and the teacher, Krishna, who is the infinite divine taken form in a human body in order to teach the practices. And Arjuna says to Krishna, one person loves you with pure devotion. Another one loves the unmanifest, or the infinite, the formless, Buddha nature. Which of these two understands yoga, or union, more deeply? And Krishna says back, those who love and revere me with unwavering faith, always centering their minds on me, they are the most perfect in yoga. But those who revere the imperishable, the unsayable, the unmanifest, the all-present, inconceivable, exalted, unchanging, eternal, mastering their senses, acting at all times with equanimity, rejoicing in the welfare of all beings, they too will reach me at last. But their path is much more arduous, because for embodied beings, the unmanifest is obscure and difficult to attain. So he's really saying that just aiming your mind toward emptiness or nothingness is quite challenging. And, you know, anyone who's ever maybe come to some of these practices, like the Dzogchen practice or the Mahamudra practice, which is a wide open, very spacious mind practice, that it's not so easy to just drop body and mind away and rest in infinite spaciousness. And so we take on these different practices of staying with the breath or different kinds of staying with the body in order to have something for the mind to land on, and that this helps the mind to settle. the attention to settle, and the thoughts to settle. And then bit by bit, glimpses of this unmanifest can begin to emerge. So Krishna here, this teacher in this book, is saying one of the best ways to let the mind really come to rest is through love, is through cultivating an intense, clear, radiant adoration or love for him. And it's the "for him" that I think gets in the way of a lot of us. And it's really a mystery. And I'll just say for myself that I was in part drawn to Buddhist practice because it was really clear and simple, and that there wasn't this distant God that I grew up with, that, and there wasn't really magic in the same way. There wasn't some mysterious there wasn't kind of a mystical process I had to go through in order to become full in my humanity. It was really sit down, pay attention. Everything's right here. The way that they say, the Buddha says, in this fathom-long body, the whole of the universe, the whole of the Dharma is found. And that really worked for me. And I love that, the clarity and the immediateness of it. But that doesn't always work. And one of the things the Buddha taught was, do whatever's necessary. Use whatever tools you need to use to stay awake, to awaken more fully. So here's a little story about that. This was several years ago. I was in Burma, practicing as a monk there for a number of months. And I'd been there a couple of months, and it was right after I had gotten ordained. So I'd taken robes and shaved my head and done the whole little ritual there. I was a little monk in the jungles of Rangoon. And within a few days of ordaining, I got a really high fever and landed in bed. And it turned out I had a wonderful tropical disease called dengue fever, and which lasts for about 10 days. And day 7 or 8, and it just gets really bad. So for a week now, then, I'm lying in my bed under my mosquito net, sweating and delirious and just, you know, a wreck, right? Hot, cold, the whole thing. And I'm a long way from home. And I get to the point where the practices that I'm being asked to do at this monastery of noting my sensations slowly and mindfully, moving really slowly and noticing movement, remaining cool and detached in the face of every sensation, are not working. And maybe I could just say, I can't do it. Maybe they work for some other folks, but in the midst of that, I wasn't able to do that. And after lots of days of this, and really no nurturing, like it's not a very nurturing little place. It's a fierce Vipassana monastery. I'm at the end of my resources. I've done everything I know how to do. I'm still really sick, and I'm far from home. And it's in the morning around breakfast time, and you know, I just sort of barely slept, bad night, the whole bit. And I'm sitting there, and I don't know what to do. I feel like just the tension in my body of helplessness is like, I have no idea what to do. And sort of out of the back of my mind, this little sort of thought comes up, and it's like, and I remember in a moment, you can ask for help. And it hadn't occurred to me up till that point, you know, stubborn American individualist. And that you can ask for help. And I was like, oh my God, I can ask for help. That's amazing. why didn't I do it so far? And I feel into what I need. And of course, what I need is like the big mama. I need like comfort and nurturing and someone to like hold on to. And I begin to chant this yogic chant that I love, the Gayatri Mantra. Om Bhur Bhuva Svaha Tat Savitur Varenyam. And it's a chant to the Divine Mother in the form of light, in the form of giving thanks for the re-arising of light in the beginning of the day, and also the way that the light is feminine and this warmth and nurturing. And as a monk, you're not allowed to sing or make music. So I do it really softly, but I'm kind of sitting in my bed and I just start, my voice is really crackling. Om Bhur Bhuva Svaha. And the doing of it, the really using the chant as a way to say, I have no more myself, so I'm asking, help me. The chant embodies that intention, that longing. And I'm only one line through the chant when then I actually feel it, like it rises up in me and I feel my helplessness. I feel lost. Rather than just being tense with it, it bubbles up, and I'm no longer alone in it. Somehow, something shifts, and I start crying. It's lovely. It's really, wow. And within two lines of the chant, there's a little knock on the door, and there's a young Burmese novice, a little 7-year-old monk in a little tiny robe. And it turns out that the kitchen has made me a special breakfast because I'm sick, and they've sent it up to me. And the little old ladies who run the monastery kitchen have made me chicken soup with rice. And, you know, yeah, it's amazing. So I'm still quite thick, of course, and I spend 10 minutes with a phrase book trying to tell the little novice that I'm vegetarian. And he doesn't get it, right? I'm sort of pointing at the like the little goose pimply skin that they've got, and I'm like, meat, meat, you know, whatever the word is, I don't remember. And he's like, no meat, no meat. And then it finally occurs to me that, you know, I called on the Great Mother and chicken soup arrived. And I'm saying no. So, yeah, thick as a board. I bow to him, I realize this, I bow. I eat the chicken soup. I get better, you know. So this being one of the huge aspects of devotional practice is longing. Is really this way that because the practice takes something that's in our heart and gives it form, sends it out into the world, that there's really this way that it becomes a vehicle for then some of the qualities of the heart that are really good to amplify, that really support practice when we amplify them. So longing is one of those. Gratitude is one of those. Praise is one of those. So in those chants that honor the Buddha, Namo Tassa, I bow to the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. That we're praising something, and that the chanting of it brings up the energy of that praise and can fill us. And if we, especially if we chant in a big group or we chant as mantra practice over and over, filling ourselves with these qualities. So I'd like to, let's chant a little together. And then I'll speak a little more. There are these chant sheets floating around. Most folks have them. If you don't, look on with someone who's nearby to you. So in order to feel some of this aspect bringing a quality of the heart out into the world. Let's do a mantra to Tara, who is this bodhisattva in the Buddhist tradition. Bodhisattva is a word in Sanskrit that means awakened being, essentially. Bodhi, same as Buddha, awake. And sattva, bodhisattva, being. And it's considered a being who has devoted their entire life stream to the process of awakening and the process of helping other beings to awaken, ultimately recognizing non-separateness. So when this one awakens, the whole thing awakens. That's kind of the bodhisattva attitude. And we each can be bodhisattvas and are in the depth of our intention as we practice, making the vow to save all beings. It's one way to practice. And there are also these beings in more in mythological space that are more like aspects of the divine, aspects of, we could say God if we like that word, or goddess if we like those words. They're imaginal forms of the infinite that we can project upon and then be nourished by as well. So on your sheet, kind of in the area where there are single line mantras, the mantra of Tara Bodhisattva goes like this: Om Tare Tutare Ture Swaha. And it's just different ways of saying her name, essentially. Om Tare Tutare Ture Swaha. So we'll just chant it for a little while. And I invite you to chant it really with the flavor of practice. So that it's not just singing, but that we're actually mindful, we're actually aware. And I'll guide us into the practice a little bit before we start. And then we'll chant it together in call and response as we did before, back and forth. For a little while, just a few minutes. So begin by dropping the attention again into the area of the heart. And feeling, starting with feeling just what's here. Feeling whatever emotional tone is present, whatever thoughts, physical sensations are present. And in the center of the heart space, imagining some area of our lives where we would like a little help. So that could be remembering the feeling of a difficult moment recently. It could be saying to yourself a thought or an idea that describes something that we want to work on, or where we feel like we don't quite have all the tools we need to solve a certain problem. If there isn't anything specific, you can also just rest in the feeling of being a child in relationship with the universe as a vast, infinite mother. So as we do this chant, you can feel into what it would be like to be in the presence of an infinitely wise, loving, compassionate mother who is available to help, is available to love us, maybe share with us tools, skillful means, easing of obstruction. Thank you. Om Tare Tutare Ture Swaha. Feeling again into the heart space. And we can feel both our longing for that which is infinite, which is free. We can feel our praise for that which is beautiful, wise, skillful, radiant, nurturing. And we can feel our gratitude for practice itself. So that practice that we just did, the practice of chanting this name of the divine, there are so many names of this divine, this manifestation of true nature. If you're drawn to chanting practice, you can explore in this tradition, other Buddhist traditions, yogic tradition, Western traditions, for an archetype of truth that resonates for you. And one of the most important things about this practice is that you like it, is that it resonates in your heart, that it's really a practice of generating more and more love for practice, for awakening. So that really, it's the loving that's the energy. It's the loving that's the engine of the practice. If the quality of longing moves you, maybe you're a Sufi. There are these poems in the Sufi tradition that really go for this longing thing. Halaj says, "Kill me, my faithful friends, for in my being killed is my life. Love is that you remain standing in front of your beloved. When you are stripped of all your attributes, then her attributes become your qualities. His attributes become your qualities. Between me and you, there is only me. Take away the me, so that only you remain." So we're using this language of lover and beloved, of you and me. But actually, we're talking about anatta, about selflessness, about surrender, renunciation. Take away the me so that only you remain. So the devotional practice can bring up this quality of renunciation of the self, that rather than letting go of the self by reflecting on or seeing the emptiness of the self, which is a really useful, wonderful method that we use a lot, of really looking at the parts of the self, this body, is it mine? Is it me? It changes, it will die, it's constantly changing, I can't actually control it. Is it me? Maybe not. The mind, even more so. Can't control it for a minute, mostly. Is it me? I hope not. The teachings say it's not. I believe them. Thank God. Faith is actually an important part of devotional practice. And faith in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So we can look at the component parts of our experience and bit by bit recognize them as inconstant, unreliable, selfless, Or we can love what is. It's not even really or, it's and. It's and or. But depending on our temperament, you know, some of us will be drawn to different kinds of practices. And some folks will really be drawn to this, to a cool, analytical, like, strip it all away. It's the same. Take away the me, so only you remain. This you is just true nature. That which is true, that which is. One way to do that, not the cool emptiness way, but the hot, warm, kind of sensual, loving way, is to love something, something divine. So, loving Buddha or Dharma, really loving, like finding the place in yourself that adores something about practice. What is it about your practice, your sitting practice, your retreat practice, your daily mindfulness, the Buddhist teachings that bring you here? What is it that you love? Like, not just what sort of works and it's a good thing to do, but that you adore, that keeps you coming back. Find what that quality is and then honor that thing, bow to that thing. Find some way of honoring it, maybe through sound, and then do that over and over until your love for that thing that keeps bringing you back is huge. And that the energy of that love then becomes a great waterfall of your practice, a great engine of your practice. Let's see, I'll read one more poem, and then if there's any questions, we'll do a minute of that. So I want to read, if I can find it, there we go. I want to read one of the great gratitude poems of the Western world. Partly because one of my, really my opening into this practice of bhakti, of devotion, was in gratitude, was on retreat practice, recognizing how amazing it was that I could be here doing this, that I could be so blessed to have this Dharma, these teachers, this Sangha, this place, this health, this material abundance, everything we have that's so, so, so supportive of it, deep inner practice that most people everywhere do not have. And my gratitude for this and for was just overwhelming. Anyway, all of that. So here's E.E. Cummings saying the same thing. And he uses the word God, but you can take God with a grain of salt if you're not a God kind of person. It really just, you know what it means. I thank you, God, for most this amazing day, for the leaping greenly spirits of trees and a blue true dream of sky, and for everything which is natural, which is infinite, which is yes. I who have died am alive again today, and this is the sun's birthday. This is the birthday of life and love and wings, and of the gay, great, happening illimitably earth. How should tasting, touching, hearing, seeing, breathing, any lifted from the know of all nothing, human, merely being, doubt, unimaginable you. Now the ears of my ears awake, and now the eyes of my eyes are opened. So just a moment for any burning kind of questions or anything that's ripe in you before we close. Yes.
Is there an aspect of chanting, especially repetitive chanting? You know, many of the chants you just do over and over, but is there just an aspect of meditation also, besides the devotional aspect of it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I didn't talk about it much here, but in the Buddhist tradition and in the yoga tradition, the use of these chants as mantra is huge. And it's a method that you can use to build up concentration, to build samadhi, really to go very, very far in practice of clarifying the mind. In the Thai tradition, often practicing with the breath, you'll practice with a meditation word, like buddho, bu on the in-breath and do on the out-breath. And there's tons of these. And you could take the mantra from your favorite archetype, say Tara, and just do it as mantra practice, you know, quietly in the mind, with the breath, riding the breath, Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Swaha, Om Tare. And really, it's a wonderful way to bring the mind into center. Yeah. Yes?
Could you talk just a moment or two about what it was like in the monastery?
What the which?
What your experience mm-hmm. was in monastery, other than the one you just
other than getting dengue fever. Mm-hmm. I can say just a tiny thing, and then we'll end. That monastic practice there, like retreat practice here, was just an incredible opportunity to devote all day every day to meditation practice, to sitting and walking practice. And to do it there in the midst of a culture that's completely steeped in Dharma practice, where when you walk out on the street in robes, like mothers will sort of press the hands of their little babies together so that they can all bow. Because there's such an honoring of the Dharma. And that they're bowing, you know, not to me, like little bald Sean from California, but to the robes, you know, really to this ancient tradition of people who give up the home life and give up a huge amount of comforts and live a very simple life, devoting themselves to clarity. And then, in turn, are both supported materially by the community and then devote their lives to the community, helping, teaching, being with people in all the stages of their lives through ritual, through teaching, through all of the ways that, that works in a culture where it's really, it really is, you know, part of the culture. So that was one of the most kind of special things about that.
Thank you for that beautiful
image of your. Oh, so amazing, little babies. They're like one, and the parents are like, Namaste, Namaste, the little babies. You know, it's amazing. All right, let's end. And let's end. We'll just chant just a few times around the mantra of metta practice, of offering loving kindness to all beings. And let's do we'll do a Sanskrit version of it tonight. And the words are Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu. And we'll just do it a few times. Loka samasta sukhino bhavantu. I think some of you have it and some of you don't on the page, but it's in with the mantras, possibly, or just follow along. Loka samasta sukhino bhavantu. So I'll sing it through once, and then we'll all sing it through together three times.
Loka samasta sukhino bhavantu.
May all beings be happy.
Loka samasta sukhino bhavantu.
Thank you. May our practice be of benefit to beings uncountable in all worlds. May our love, our devotion, our gratitude, praise, our longing, our honoring of that which is true, may it flow out from our bodies in all directions to touch the hearts of all beings in all times and places in ways that we can't even imagine. May our practice bear fruit. May all beings be safe from harm of all kinds. May all beings be at peace, sheltered, nurtured, loved. May all beings be completely free from suffering, realizing infinite love, infinite truth, complete freedom.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.